so he clicked on the Our Areas page. A map of the safari area eventually loaded, and he took a small notebook and pencil from his pack to take note of the location. The area was in one of the hunting blocks that bordered the Nyasa National Reserve, a vast wilderness area in northern Mozambique along the border with Tanzania. The map wasn't interactive, so Rhys made a sketch of its proximity to terrain features, including the river that bordered the safari area and the closest town of Montepuez, which is where the paved roads ended. After waiting painfully for Google Maps to load, he found the approximate location of the safari area, and instead of dropping a pin, he used the scale in the bottom right-hand corner to estimate distance. The camp was at least 5 hours from Pemba by car, and that was being generous, considering the likely condition of the roads. It was probably more like an 8-hour trip during this, the rainy season. Besides, he didn't have a car, so the point was moot. He did a search for RH Safaris and among various links and junk results, found a trip report from a previous safari client on a hunting message board. The report described the hunter's trip down to the most minute of details, including his clothing and ammunition choices. Fortunately, this attention to detail also described the air charter service he'd used. Pemba Air Charters listed an address on Avenue de Marginal near the airport, meaning that he had walked directly past it this morning. Given the remote location of the safari area, Rhys figured the charter service likely served as a regular shuttle to and from the camp, and that the individuals involved would have a strong working relationship. Rather than trying to buy a truck or motorcycle to navigate his way to the camp while avoiding police and military, chartering a plane was course of action one. He wrote down the address and phone number before deleting the browser history and heading for the door. He nodded at the attendant and went back out into the slow-motion hustle and bustle of the coastal African city. The same Toyota taxi that had dropped Rhys off was still waiting, and the driver treated him like a long-lost brother. Currency breeds loyalty in certain parts of the world. Well, most of them, anyway. Rhys handed the address to the driver, who nodded and steered the car back into traffic. A few minutes later, they were at their destination. Rhys gave the driver another 10, and this time the man handed him a business card and pointed at the phone number. "Call me if you need me again." Rhys nodded in understanding. The world headquarters of Pemba Air Charters was a faded baby blue single-family home surrounded by an iron gate with brick columns. The windows of the building were covered with burglar bars, and an older Suzuki minivan parked just inside the gate had a magnetic Pemba Air Charters logo on the door. Rhys pressed the doorbell button on the brick column and put on his best smile. The front door of the house opened, and a short, broad-chested white man wearing sandals, blue athletic shorts, and a faded olive T-shirt stepped out, squinting his eyes in the bright sunlight. He walked half the distance between the house and the gate. "Can I help you?" he asked in the heavily accented English of East Africa. "I'm looking for Pemba Air Charters. Am I in the right place?"
"You are. We just don't get many walk-ins."
He walked to the gate, fishing a key ring out of his pocket, and extended his hand.
"I'm Jeff."
"Richard Connell. Nice to meet you," Rhys improvised.
"Come on in, Mr. Connell. It's bloody hot out here, eh?"
"Thanks, I appreciate it."
Rhys followed Jeff inside. What would have been the family room of the house was set up as an office with a desk, an office chair, and a sofa in the center of the room. He assumed that Jeff both worked out of and lived here.
"Sit your bags down anywhere. Can I get you anything? A beer?"
"No, I'm fine, thanks."
"Have a seat."
Jeff pointed at the couch as he made his way around the desk and took a seat behind it.
"American, eh?"
"More of a world traveler."
"I guess so, if you're walking around Pemba. What can we do for you?"
"I'm looking to charter a flight to the RH Safaris camp near Nyasa."
"Ah, yes, we do a good bit of work with them."
You realize that it's not the hunting season, though, right?
I do. I'm not headed there to hunt.
I am a friend of the Hastings family and thought I would visit Mr. Hastings since I was in this part of the world.
Right. Jeff nodded skeptically.
We can help with that for sure, eh? I need to call them and make sure that someone is in camp before we put in a flight plan.
I completely understand. You can tell him that Utalivu's friend from college wants to visit.
Right. Let's give him a call then, eh?
Jeff picked up a desk phone and dialed a number from memory. 10 seconds later, the call was answered on the other end.
Hey, bro, it's Jeff. I've got an oak here who wants to visit you. Says he's a college friend of Utalivu, whoever the fuck that is.
Jeff winked at Reese to let him know that he was joking.
Right, okay then. Let me take a look at the weather. See you soon. Need me to bring you anything?
Right. Jeff hung up the phone and looked up at Reese.
He said to bring you in as soon as possible. I'll check the weather and we'll see about getting you there today.
That's great. Thanks, Jeff. How much do I owe you?
You must be a good friend of Rich, he said to add it to his tab.
Within an hour, they were loading Reese's bags into a small truck and backing through the driveway gate. Jeff had changed into his pilot uniform and carried a black chart case, identical to the ones used by commercial pilots the world over. It took them 3 minutes to drive onto the airport grounds, and much to Reese's relief, Jeff drove around the terminal and directly onto the tarmac and stopped next to a high-wing, single-engine turboprop aircraft. The Cessna 208 Caravan could hold up to 9 passengers, but Jeff and Reese would be the only occupants on this trip. Reese loaded his bags while Jeff went to handle some business with the aviation authorities. It was too hot to sit in the plane, so Reese took a seat on the door's step and rested in the shade of the wing. Jeff returned after a few minutes and began pre-flighting the plane, instructing Reese to sit in the right seat of the cockpit. There was no sign of police or military activity at the field, but nonetheless, Reese breathed a silent sigh of relief when they were finally airborne. Chapter 19. Nyasa Game Reserve, Mozambique, Africa, March. The flight to camp took them an hour and a half, with Jeff playing the part of tour guide over the headsets as they flew. He pointed out rivers, towns, and villages along the green and brown landscape, giving Reese the lay of the land. The last town of any size before camp was Montepuez, but from the air, it looked to be nothing more than a few buildings. Jeff indicated the river that formed the boundary of the hunting area as they passed it, and it still took 10 minutes of flying to reach the runway. He had certainly chosen one of the most remote spots on the globe to come to die. Reese noticed a white pickup parked alongside the red dirt runway, which Jeff circled to approach into the wind. The pilot lowered the flaps and eased back on the throttle, dropping the Cessna on a glide path toward the earth below. The plane touched down gently and bounced along the runway until it slowed to a stop in front of the vehicle. Through the plane's windshield, Reese immediately recognized the man standing by the white Land Cruiser as Rich Hastings, Rafe's uncle and the owner of RH Safaris. He had aged quite a bit since Reese had seen him last. It was hard to believe that almost 20 years had passed since that summer in Zimbabwe. His short hair was stark white, which contrasted drastically with his deeply tanned skin. He stood more than 6 feet tall and had the lean build of an endurance athlete, the ropey veins of his muscled forearms visible below the rolled-up sleeves of his starched green safari-style shirt. He wore short shorts and sandals without socks. His face broke into a wide smile when he saw Reese descend from the plane's cabin and walked forward to meet him.
"James, good to see you, young man."
He shook Reese's hand with an iron grip and slapped him on the back with his other hand, greeting him as he would a long-lost nephew.
"Great to see you, Mr. Hastings. Thank you so much for not turning me away." "Of course, James, you are like family. Family is always welcome, especially when they are in need."
The twinkle in his blue eyes told Reese that Mr. Hastings was well aware of his fugitive status.
"Do you have any bags I can help you with?"
"I can get them, thanks." Reese climbed into the Cessna's cabin and handed his duffel down to Richard, who was standing in the doorway. He slung his pack over one shoulder and approached the cabin to thank Jeff for the ride.
"Thanks so much for getting me here, Jeff. I really appreciate it."
"No worries, eh, mate? Hopefully I'll see you again. If you need a ride anywhere, Rich knows how to get hold of me. Best of luck to you."
"Thanks."
The men shook hands and Reese climbed down the steps to the dirt runway. His bag was already loaded into the bed of the Land Cruiser and Rich Hastings motioned for him to get on the passenger side. The older man started the truck and pulled onto a track that led away from the runway. Reese was taking in the landscape in silence when Hastings spoke.
"I'm only going to mention this once, James. Bloody awful business about your family. I read up on it. A young reporter seemed to have the inside scoop. I tried asking Rafe about it, but you know him. Elusive bastard,"
Hastings said with a smile while shifting gears.
"The reports mentioned something about brain tumors in your men."
Reese remained silent.
"Well, you'll let me know if you need a doctor, eh? Then you're welcome to stay here as long as you'd like. I'd say the chances of them finding you in Mozambique are pretty slim, so long as you don't stick your head up too high."
"I appreciate it, sir. I really do."
"We don't get much in the way of outside news here, James. Our focus is the land and its game. I guess that's why we're all out here. The camp doesn't even have internet. All our bookings come through a hunting concierge service out of Georgia, and they call us the old-fashioned way, on the telephone. There's only one in camp, and it's in the main office. That's a big attraction for clients, actually. Here, they can forget about the modern world that has them constantly connected. No choice out here. If you want to be off the grid, this is your place."
"Thank you. That suits me just fine."
"You struck me as a good lad when you were here last. We won't speak of it again,"
Hastings declared, pulling into the safari camp.
"You look like a bloody skeleton. We've got a big dinner cooking. We'll see if we can put some meat back on those bones."
"I can't wait. It has been a long time since I've had a decent meal. Or a beer."
"We'll get you caught up on both then. You can get washed up and then we'll eat."
Camp was a series of structures made of stone, timber, mud, and thatch. There was a massive barn-like common building with an open-air dining room, bar, and seating area. A detached kitchen building sat nearby, and a series of guest cottages were strung laterally along the ridge that faced the river below. There was also a shop for maintaining the vehicles, a skinning shed, walk-in refrigerated storage, and staff quarters. Hastings led Reese down a stone path to one of the guest cottages and showed him the amenities. It was basic, but it was clean and well-maintained, and the view was amazing. Home, sweet African home. Reese had just enough time to get his bags situated when a polite female voice from outside his hooch told him that it was time for dinner. He headed for the bathroom to clean himself up and barely recognized the man who stared back at him in the mirror. Long, sun-bleached hair, bronze skin framing the pale white where his sunglasses had blocked the rays, a visibly broken nose from its meeting with the ship's wheel, and a beard that nearly touched his chest. His eyes were set deep by the drastic loss of body weight, the rest of his face obscured by his gray-streaked facial hair. He didn't figure on dinner being too formal in this corner of the world, but the last thing he wanted to do was offend his generous hosts. He turned on the shower and dropped his clothes to the stone floor before stepping into the stream of warm water. Nothing in his life had ever felt better. Standing still for what seemed like an eternity, he let the water wash the salt and grime from his matted hair. There were shampoo and a bar of soap on a shelf cut into the stone wall, and he lathered himself carefully, making sure to hit every inch. He stepped out of the shower feeling more human than beast and toweled dry. Using his fingers, he worked the tangles out of his wet hair, slicking it back as best he could without the benefit of a comb or brush. A toothbrush and toothpaste had been laid out for him, and after rationing toothpaste throughout his transoceanic voyage, he enjoyed the luxury of squirting a giant dollop onto his brush and scrubbing away. He found a short-sleeved white polo shirt and a pair of lightweight pants that looked to be about his size laid out on his bed when he emerged from the shower. Obviously, Rich had canvassed the camp for clothes that might fit his guest. Donning his new apparel, Rhys declared himself as presentable as possible and exited into the cool evening air. He assumed that dinner would be served in the open-air dining room he'd seen on the way in, so he followed the stone path in that direction. Sure enough, he entered the massive thatched-roof living and dining area to find Hastings standing by a small bar with three younger men. Despite Rhys's visions of colonial Africa, none of the men were dressed any more formally than he was. Hastings spotted Rhys as he entered the room and waved him over.
"James, come, come." He motioned toward the younger men. "James, this is Louis, Mike, and Darren. They are my PHs here in this concession."
Anywhere else in the world, they would be known as hunting guides, but in Africa, they are known as professional hunters and are subject to various licensing standards. To be a PH in Mozambique, you have to meet the requirements of neighboring Zimbabwe, which had the toughest PH standards in all of Africa. These men knew their business. The three men, each at least as tall as Rhys, extended their hands and greeted him warmly and politely. They looked to be in their late 20s or early 30s, and all had the same long and lean build as Hastings. They were deeply tanned with sun-beaten skin that gave them the faces of men in their 40s or 50s. These were hard men.
"What are you drinking, James? We have plenty of booze, beer, and wine."
Beer would be great, thanks. Richard motioned to the youngest looking of the men.
"Mike, get Mr. Rhys here a beer, please."
What little alcohol had been on the sailboat had been consumed in the Azores, and Rhys hadn't had a drink in what seemed like an eternity. The young man handed him an ice-cold can of beer.
"Cheers, mate."
Rhys took a long drink that disappeared at least half the can. He couldn't remember a better-tasting beer in his life.
"First sip is the best, eh?" Hastings said, smiling. "James here has had a long trip. He is a friend of my nephew, Rafe, whom you all know, and he is going to be spending as much time with us as he likes. He needs to keep a bit of a low profile, though, so he will stay out of sight when we have clients in camp, eh? I know that each of you will respect that."
Each man nodded soberly at his boss's request.
"James, it's our honor to have you here, but we're going to put you to work. I want you to rest up and eat for the next few days, then you can go out scouting with Louis, and we'll make a plan from there."
"I appreciate it, Mr. Hastings."
"Rich, please, call me Rich. You ready for another beer?"
Rhys had been around Australians and New Zealanders on multiple deployments and had come to respect their ability to consume quantities of alcohol that would put most men in the hospital. It became immediately apparent that this was a talent shared by his new African friends. After a few minutes, dinner was served for the five men at a dining table that looked like it could hold at least 20. This camp was primitive, but Rich made sure that it maintained an air of first-world civility, complete with white tablecloths, linen napkins, and crystal wine glasses that were kept full with a seemingly endless flow of South African pinotage. A salad of fresh vegetables was served along with a medium-rare fillet of some of the best meat Rhys had ever tasted, which turned out to be eland. After surviving on a small supply of canned goods and fresh-caught fish for weeks, Rhys's body was starving for